This is The Stark Truth, hosted by Robert Stark. Brought to you by StarkTruthRadio.com. Robert Stark is an American journalist and political commentator. You can listen to his podcast at www.StarkTruthRadio.com.
Robert Stark. I'm joined here with Faust. He is a Dutch YouTuber. He has two YouTube channels on politics, one in English and one in Dutch. Faust, it's great speaking with you.
Thank you very much. Pleasant to be here.
To start things off, can you give sort of a brief background about yourself? The material you generally cover in your YouTube channel, and with the name Faust, is that a reference to the Faustian archetype, or is it you just picked it randomly?
No, that's my real name.
Okay.
I know no one ever believes me when I tell them that, but no, my name's just Faust. It's a Germanic name, and one side of my family is German, so that's the reason, really.
So you identify as like a Dutch nationalist, or just sort of broadly like pan-Germanic?
Oh, very much like a Dutch nationalist, but with strong Germanic sympathies, I'd say. So generally, I think I would describe myself as to be a fairly old-fashioned nationalist. But unfortunately, the sort of petty romantic nationalism is less and less possible due to geopolitical and economic and so on realities. So I'm more of a pan-Germanicist as a sort of practical solution to problems of modernity, because I think the EU has some fundamental problems in it which are hard to solve, namely differences in culture, differences in economic cycle, differences in productivity, differences in culture. But a Germanic Union could be a strong enough geopolitical entity to solve some of the issues of the EU while at the same time fulfilling the needs of current nationalism, which is to be a strong European bloc on the world stage.
So hypothetically, as an alternative, like there's the EU, and then there's kind of nationalism based on individual nations, and then there's that bloc of Central Eastern European countries, including, it's not official like the EU, but includes like Hungary, Poland, Slovakia, Czechia.
And yeah, the Visegrad group.
Oh, Visegrad, that's right. So like a Germanic Union, hypothetically, would be Germany, Netherlands, Scandinavia, or where would the UK fit into that?
I think the UK neither wants to be part of any continental European Union, nor do they have they historically really been inclined towards that. They've always kind of been separate from continental politics, always kind of being an outside player. So I think they'll always want to be on their own island, but they're still kind of part of Europe. I think the most pragmatic solution is to just kind of split up into the three blocks we have now, sort of anyway, are the Slavic countries, the Germanic countries, and the Latin countries. And if we just sort of formalize that a little more, that would be a reasonably practical solution. It could still be within the framework of some of the things the EU has, like common defense policy, or even cultural exchange like the Erasmus program and so on. But it can't be economic as much, because one of the fundamental problems we have, of course, is the euro, which is a disuniting factor.
So with the historic background, you've done a number of videos about the Anglo-Saxon culture, and how much of a rivalry was there between the British? Historically, Netherlands has been closer to Germany, obviously, linguistically and ethnically. And how does the culture relate to the Anglo-Saxon world, like the contrast of the Calvinist values and the monarchy with British classical liberalism, and also like Carl Schmitt's concept of like a sea people versus a land-oriented people, and the Germans being more land-oriented as opposed to the British, and also the Dutch as well.
Yeah, this is a lot of stuff that I do talk about in my videos, so I kind of didn't mention it, but my English language channel is mostly focused about these sorts of philosophical, geopolitical, and economic ideas. My background is particularly in economics, so that's one of the things I like to talk about. And another thing I like to talk about is the aspects of technology, how technology influences changes in society, namely, and how that changes things for nationalist perspective, which we tend to ignore a bit in our current discourse. So yeah, this is one of those topics to talk about. I'm pretty opposed to the English due to historical reasons, but also philosophical reasons. I don't like the English worldview, the liberal worldview, and traditionally this was not the Dutch worldview either. We had, as you say, the Calvinist worldview, which is much more traditional Christian, verging on the Puritan, really. It's very, very harsh. I think for an American perspective, you could probably compare it best to sort of the way Amish live, I guess, or at least their perspective on the world. And yeah, us being an in-between nation, right in smack dab between Germany and England, of course, often meant we had to ally with one or the other in different wars and conflicts. But because Germany was a disunited place for, well, up until 1870, of course, we mostly fought the English in a whole series of trade wars, naval wars. There's these historic rivalries. And, you know, in the Dutch nationalist scene, it's kind of a bit of a meme to hate the English. It's, I don't know, it's become kind of a joke because the English never understand where it's coming from. So for us, it's very funny to talk about that.
And there's a debate about, like, what are your thoughts on the debate about the origins of capitalism, whether it's the British or the Dutch?
I think it's a bit of a mixture of both. Some of the things originated here, some of them originated in England. There's a fundamental distinction in how we looked and practiced capitalism, though. The traditional model in the Netherlands is what we call the Rhine model of capitalism, which is also the German model of capitalism. And that's actually more similar than feudalism than you think. It's very much a sort of paternalistic, top-down economics. So, for example, big companies like in Germany, Krupp, and in Netherlands, Philips, they would almost be feudal lords over a certain area, and they'd protect their workers, and they'd have this sort of what later would develop into the concept of a Volksstaat, where workers and boss work together in a sort of circular economy. One of the ways of thinking was the big difference with the Anglo-Saxon model of capitalism, which is the other one, which is the normal international model now, is shareholders and profit comes first. So if a company goes bankrupt, then first the shareholders are compensated. In the Rhineland model of economics, it's the reverse. It's first the employees, then the bosses, and then the shareholders always come last. So the idea is you preserve the company as best as possible. You try to make the company last as long as possible. You try to protect the interests of workers. So while we both had big roles in developing capitalism such as it is today, we up until the, I guess, 1950s or so, had very different ways of implementing capitalism. But yeah, historically speaking, of course, the first stock market was in the Netherlands, but the first central bank was in England, so on, you know.
So you would say that the Prime Minister, Mark Rutte, in the Netherlands, he's basically like a center-right neoliberal. So like, what do these political labels mean that get thrown out? Like, what's a liberal? What's conservative? What's right-wing? What's left-wing? Like, what does it mean in Netherlands, different parts of continental Europe, as opposed to like, what's a conservative Republican in the U.S.? What's a Tory in the U.K.? Like, how would you contrast these labels and Mark Rutte's like policy and outlook with, say, like the Tories and Boris Johnson?
Well, it's it used to be that we had very different politics, but it's become homogenized to the American standard. So while we don't have a two-party system, we actually have 13 parties. The sort of general perspectives of the different parties have fused together much, much more. So back in the day, we would have different interpretations of Christianity being dominant. We'd have the liberals, we'd have the social democrats, we have the socialists, the communists, the greens. And now it's more or less fused into, you've got the populists, which is Wilders and Baudet. You've got the remnants of the former Christian parties, which is SGP, CDA, CU. And these are less and less a significant factor in politics. And then you've got the liberals, which would be the VVD and to an extent D66. And then for the rest, you've got what we could just call the homogenized left, which behaves pretty much exactly like an American would call the left, because they take all of their cultural cues, their policies from American perspectives. They really talk as if this is America. You know, they talk about gay rights and equality, and it sounds just like they're from America. And our liberals, they're still a little bit of the old-fashioned classical liberal in there, so they're more pro-free speech.
Just overall more free speech, like there's not the not the same like draconian hate speech laws in, say, the UK or Germany?
No, we don't have those. In fact, funnily enough, Holocaust denial was actually decriminalized here in 2012 by the liberals. But now we are getting, because of developments elsewhere, you know, we're a small country, we don't get to set the cultural agenda of the world, so because of influences from America, from Germany, we are getting these hate speech laws now. There's a lot of proposals there to amend the constitution to make it possible to make hate speech illegal. So that's coming. I'd say we are in a little bit of a delay there. But yeah, because, you know, world culture has become so homogenized, whatever happens in the United States becomes influences first the big countries here, and then it hits us as well.
What are your thoughts on some of these sort of like anti-establishment parties? Do you support any? And with Geert Wilders, he seems to be kind of aligned with like in America, the American dissidents, what would be described as like the alt-right. And then there's also Baudet. Like, what are your thoughts on both Wilders and Baudet's parties?
I'd say Wilders is more harsh than your alt-light. At least in his rhetoric, he's always been he's been pro-remigration. He wants completely closed borders. He wants to make the burqa illegal, mosques illegal, ban the Quran. So he's, if he were to be compared to the alt-light, he'd be more on the harder side of the alt-light. I'd say he's a pretty good politician. He's not managed to achieve very much, but I think he has been a big influence on the culture, because it's become very, very normalized to have this sort of anti-Islam rhetoric, to be pro-remigration, to be pro-closed borders. He's really normalized those standpoints. While Baudet was sort of an experiment, and unfortunately it's an experiment that's really turning worse and worse. It's interesting because just today the PVV, which is Wilders' party, actually presented their party program in which they want remigration and mosques closed and so on and so on. And Baudet at the same time is actually proposing that we have an Australian model of migration. So we allow in experts, and which would effectively mean we continue to have migration. And on the whole, Baudet has had a few moments where he was very good, where he, for example, talked about Renaud Camus, and he talked about the Great Replacement, and he talked about Welbeck, and he even had some MGTOW sort of talking points about women. But on the whole, it's a very confused mess. So would I support either of them? I think I'd have to support Wilders simply by lack of good alternatives.
Yeah, I mean, you certainly, I mean, I wouldn't put him in the same category as like Nigel Farage.
I think Wilders is more hard-line than Farage, to be honest.
Farage is pretty much like almost like a, he's almost more comparable to like an American mainstream conservative in a lot of ways, even despite Brexit.
Yeah, I'd say so. I mean, Wilders is an advocate for Nexit as well. So in that way, he's comparable to Farage, but he's much more hard-line on migration. He wants completely closed borders. He wants no one to come in. And he wants to actively have a policy of remigration and cultural intolerance, especially towards Islam. So I think that's, I mean, realistically speaking, that's the only option we really have to get going on keeping this nation somewhat Dutch, I'd say.
There seems to be like an economic divide within the right or within nationalism. So with like British, the British right is more closer to like Thatcherites and Reaganites, mm-hmm. and kind of neoliberal economics. And then with Marine Le Pen adopting more positions on economics, like positions that are that Americans might associate with the left. Like, what are your thoughts on that divide, and are you supportive of adopting more left-wing economics?
Well, the Wilders' party is actually pretty much socially democratic when it comes to economics, very much in favor of the welfare state and benefits and the better healthcare and all that stuff. So in that sense, he's pretty left-wing. My personal views on economics are a bit more complex. I'm very hard on eugenics, and I consider to be welfare to be a way to keep weakness inside the group. So I'm generally in favor of a tempered sort of free market, because free markets can also be destabilizing towards the nation. And there is no such thing as a real true free market. I mean, the big preacher of the free market, the United States, uses the IMF and uses unequal trade deals to control international markets. They use the dollar is a weapon of power. And anyone who doesn't submit to this economic control is faced with, you know, regime change or, in the worst case, an invasion to bring you some democracy. So free trade has never really existed. It's always the big power players using rhetoric like that to achieve their own aims. Back when we were the preeminent trade power in the world, when the Dutch Republic was just completely reliant on trade and we had the naval power to enforce it, we had the discussion of Mare Liberum versus Mare Clausum. Should international waters exist? Should anyone be able to trade with anyone? And back then, we were big proponents of free markets. But that was because it was to our own benefit, and we could challenge other people in trade wars, and we could benefit from free trade. And the English back then were opposed to free trade. Then when the English surpassed us and they became the preeminent naval power, suddenly they were in favor of free trade. So free trade is always something that is argued by the powerful to have a sort of moral cover for their own benefit.
This definition, neoliberalism, the term is kind of used as like a catch-all phrase to describe the establishment and the political power structure. It's often described as the idea that people are just an economic unit and not linked mm-hmm. to any kind of wider identity beyond one that can be bought as a consumer. How would you define neoliberalism?
Oh, I think that's, at least in its most direct economic sense, I think that's pretty true. It is a very materialist philosophy. But I don't know, it's a worldview as well, right? I mean, everything has its own moral basic assumptions in how they see the world, and even neoliberalism is an ethos of a sort, even if it's a very shallow one. So I do think it also holds a number of the common liberal views about, you know, equality, egalitarianism, and so on, humanism, secularism. And so this whole idea of spreading democracy by the sword, as it has done in the British Empire and the American Empire, I think that is a core part of its ethos. It's not just a power play. It's also, at least in when it started, maybe these days it's more cynical, but I think when it started, this was seen as a moral ethos to bring democracy, to bring equality.
So you have videos on the welfare state and economic policy. You're generally opposed mm-hmm. to the welfare state. And yes. What are your responses to arguments that people who are, a lot of dissidents are losing their jobs because corporations are hostile to them, and that like a UBI could free people up to express their views politically and not being dependent upon hostile institutions? And with a lot of the like ongoing economic changes, it's becoming much harder to have a source of income that's outside either the government or some kind of mega corporation, like a dystopian scenario where everyone works for Amazon, and issues with like funding the creative dissidents, but then also the creative class. And if you don't support like a strong UBI, do you see something like patronage networks and guilds as a solution, which ideally should be the case, but people are pretty atomized?
Okay, that's a lot of ones to go through, so let's go by that one by one. Generally, yes, I am opposed to the welfare state because I think it creates weakness and it's not beneficial to people's independence or the optimization of their skill set. I'm generally more in favor of a distributist model of, if you want to call it welfare, where your first reliance is upon family and religious networks and friends rather than the state. Because if you don't have a welfare state, it also means you've got more wealth because you're taxed less and so on. It helps build community when you're more reliant on family, when you're in a charity network where you help each other. And I think it's more eugenic not to have welfare. Now for UBI, I don't think UBI will give you political freedom. On the contrary, I think if you're income dependent upon the state, and we have a state, as we see today, that is increasingly willing to use its power to crush dissidents, and it's less and less relevant how small of a dissident you are. They'll crush you if you're some anonymous Twitter account, even. If you're reliant upon the state for your income, you're going to be even more careful with your words. So I don't think that's going to help the dissidents at all. I think dissidents will be helped by being economically independent, by having small business, by being independent contractors, by having skill sets which can't easily be competed out of the market. Because I do think you have to consider that automation is on the way. We've got a lot of technological changes coming up that will price you out of the market, that will make certain job sets irrelevant, like truck drivers, like food service industry, and so on. So I think we need to try as much as possible to build parallel economies, which will rely on having, if you're a nationalist and you want to be independent of the government as much as possible, you're going to just have to develop skill set in which you have the ability to earn money, even if you have, if, you know, you don't have to contract with big corporations, like if you're an independent electrician, for example, or you're in some other way skillful. If you're a lawyer who's willing to take on fringe cases, that'll be a niche market you can enter into. So, no, I wouldn't say UBI is really a solution. What I do find funny is that in a way, UBI might well become inevitable because, as I say, automatization is very much coming up quickly, and it's going to make quite a lot of the job market irrelevant. And in that way, I guess, in a sense, Marx was right. Then, on how hard it would be to have any sort of income outside of government and mega corporations. Well, as I say, find yourself a niche, a skill that's not easy to replace, where there are few people who are willing to do it, and you're guaranteed an income. As for the creative, I don't know. In my perspective, creative people have always been on the poverty line, except when they find a mecenas. So I don't really have good answers for you there.
Yeah, your economic view is, you'd say, like, closer to... you're not, like, a far-right... right-wing economically, you're more kind of like a distributist.
Yes. I'd say I very much believe that a strong middle class is the foundation of a nation, and I believe also that nationalism is an ideology for the middle class and working class as a weapon to unite them against powers that would exploit them, whether these be foreign powers or corporate powers, plutocrats. I very much think of nationalism as the united working and middle classes. And it's an ideology for us because it doesn't benefit elites, generally speaking, nationalism.
So you are critical of American influence, obviously military, economic, and cultural hegemony. You had a video why you want to disassociate with the American movement. There's all these examples, like both like Black Lives Matter and woke politics are spreading into Europe, but also things like... QAnon are impacting conservative movements and the right as well. So is the issue just with the American establishment or even just like influence Americans involved in dissident politics?
Both. I think America on the whole is a negative influence on many levels. I think America's kind of been rotted from the inside. So it's kind of lost its culture, it's lost what it was about. I talk sometimes to people who are of the sort of southern separatist sort of thing, and I have some interest in American literature, so I'm familiar with 19th century American literature and the beginning of the 20th century cinema and literature. And I really think that that's the peak of what America was about, this sort of frontier independence period, this somewhat aristocratic plantation owner sort of being. And that's all dead. That's all gone. So I think America has... It was a young civilization when it had a civilization, when it had a culture. And that's died. And now it's the hedonistic decadence of what Rome was in its later days. So I think that it has very little positive things to spread in the world. Your economic system is decadent, and things like inflationary ideas, Wall Street banking. The American military hegemony is, of course, negative, because you could say it's not a bad thing to have a strong military that would defend Western civilization. And so if we had America as just being the soldiers of Western civilization and they would defend us against external threats, that wouldn't be so bad. But the thing is, it's always the American soldier serves mostly corporate interests. And whenever they invade Iraq or Syria or Libya, that's not generally good for Europe. And also it creates a culture of decadence in European powers. We don't have strong militaries anymore. We don't have a martial culture anymore. And I very much don't like that. I do believe we should have mandatory military service again and our own militarist spirit. So it promotes decadence in that way as well. Then there's the cultural emptiness of Hollywood, which is just bland and has no depth. And unfortunately, this isn't very much countered, in my opinion, by a strong American folk culture either. I do believe there used to be. There were folk tales. I mean, you've got your tales of your Wendigos, your Johnny Appleseeds, and so on. But I don't see those referenced much in modern American pop culture anymore. So I think that's, as I say, gone as well. So the cultural influence isn't good. The fact that you spread English everywhere, that's also destroying our native languages. And then it also goes into dissident politics and normal politics. The left here talks like they're in America, like when someone is killed in America, they have a demonstration here about police brutality, where no one is killed here pretty much by the police.
Or even, I'm not sure about continental Europe, it happened, but it was like in the UK, they were like, Black Lives Matter was like destroying all the statues, and like they're pushing. I think it's more mild in continental Europe, but in the UK, it's like the movement is just as extreme as the US.
Yeah, well, it's coming over here too. There were demonstrations for Black Lives Matter here too. There was no violence, but there were demonstrations. In fact, tomorrow, next Sunday, they're going to have a demonstration against fascism in Amsterdam because of the Capitol Hill storming. So these people psychologically live in the United States. They act as if the things that happen in the United States are happening here. And, you know, it's very hard to have a culture or a country when a significant amount of the people don't act as if they live in that country. So that's a big problem, in my opinion. But this also applies not just to the left, but also the right. A lot of nationalists, when I started in this movement, which was about 5 or 6 years ago now, we were taking our cues from the American dissident right. We were reading Countercurrents, and we were reading Amran, and we were watching, YouTube channels by dissidents, and we were talking about how bad conservatives were and so on, which is completely unrelated to things happening here. So this psychological influence it has on us and our politics, that's also negative. So I think on the whole, there's very few positive things America contributes to the world anymore. I think it had something to contribute, say, 100 years ago.
And with, like, the current events, like what happened in D.C. this past week, Trump had this rally, and he was revving up his base, like, talking about the election being rigged and then refusing to concede. Mm-hmm. And then basically he did concede right afterwards, so the thing is he basically did basically throw his supporters to the wolves, and obviously what happened was pretty reckless, because those people didn't really think about like the repercussions, and a lot of them are facing like draconian prison sentences, and we're seeing this like overall crackdown on free speech and deplatforming on social media. But what are your overall thoughts on the situation in America?
I'm still unsure. I have this general policy of not commenting on current events because I always think you're never going to get it right while things are developing. So everything you're going to say is going to be sheer speculation. You can only analyze events really properly after they've sort of happened and you can look back more accurately. But I'd say, yeah, this was a bad move on the part of Trump and his supporters, because it gave ammunition to the left to do everything they wanted to do anyway. It just made things easier for them. I mean, these things were going to happen anyway, right? But now it's much easier for them to do, much easier to justify, and they can do it much faster. As for the general situation in the United States, I don't know what to predict. I'm not an America expert. I hear a lot of talk of succession and so on. I don't think that will happen. I think what will happen is you're going to have a little bit like a Weimar situation where there's constant low-level street violence, but you've got also a tyrannical government. So I just think things are going to be unpleasant and unpredictable. And one thing I see is that the left is very much more organized and united and willing and able to use force. And if they use force, they get away with it. Whereas the American right wing on all levels is disorganized. Any action they take is harshly punished. They have no way to protect themselves from that. Their own leadership in the Republican Party does not seem to protect them or be even aware of what's coming to them, because they can cuck, but it's not going to save them. So I think on the whole, it's going to be very unpleasant to be right-wing in America in the coming few years, and I'm not sure if an American right-wing movement will even survive.
Yeah, like the whole like Black Lives Matter movement was talking a lot about police, bringing attention to police brutality and all that, and like you had this video about the police issue and community policing, but I actually see like the opposite is happening. Like we're seeing a much more oppressive, centralized police state.
Yeah, oh, very much so, yeah. You see that in the UK the most, I think. That's where it's most visible.
And, yeah, with Trump, Trump had the whole rhetoric about, like, the election being stolen. And I don't buy into that. I think that Trump actually did lose because of his own failings to deliver on populism. And he basically became a pretty kind of normie conservative, and it's actually the worst of both worlds, because now Trump supporters are being treated as like basically like neo-Nazis, but the policies are basically like mainstream conservative policies of like tax cuts for corporations. So the Trump narrative about the election, that's nonsense. But I do think there is this issue that you had a video on that basically mass liberal democracy inevitably does lead to oligarchy.
Well, it enables it, right? I made this video, I think it was one of the Dutch ones, where I talked about how, yeah, liberal values and liberal democracy is more and more just an excuse to allow plutocrats to remain in power and exercise power. You see this, for example, with what they're doing with banning people of Twitter and so on, and banning all these apps. They're just saying, well, we're protecting liberal democracy, we're protecting humanist values and democracy, and if you oppose this, you're a fascist. So, you know, well, the actual things they implement are not liberal necessarily or democratic. It's just top-down elite plutocratic rule, but still wave this flag of liberalism to justify it.
And looking at the kind of post-pandemic economic trends, like there's this kind of, like automation has been accelerated, just like an overall centralization of the economy, political power being centralized under corrupt elites, and this kind of a trend towards neo-feudalism. And then there's the frog in the boiling pan theory versus the theory that like the power structure pushes things too far and backfires. But I think there is a problem with the kind of collapse theory of crisis politics and accelerationism, who are already in power, they have like the infrastructure to take advantage of the crisis.
Yeah, this doom posting about civilizational failure, I don't think so. That's not historically how civilizations have failed anyway, with some big crisis or collapse. Rome took 2 centuries to fall. A period of decadence lasted very long, and it's lost power and power, and the society became worse and worse, and its currency became more and more debased. But it didn't fall overnight. It took centuries. And that's what I think will happen if the West, and especially America, because I think these things are much worse in America, and America is the trendsetter for the rest of the world in this. It won't be a civil war, and it won't be a sudden economic collapse. It'll be continuous, slow decline. For example, an economic collapse. What we're seeing now with the dollar is 25% of all dollars that have ever been printed were printed this year, and we're seeing a massive flood away from the dollar. This is one of the reasons why cryptos are up so much. Institutional investors are looking for anything to ditch their dollars. Anything is an asset as long as it's not dollars. So they're buying cryptos, they're buying lease car companies, they're buying here in the Netherlands, they're buying bike leasing companies. Everything's going into a lease model, because at least then the companies can buy assets and have a revenue stream rather than holding dollars. And this will, of course, continuously, slowly erode away the purchasing power, the value of the wages of the Americans. So, you get your $15 minimum wage if Bernie Sanders would get his way, but it doesn't matter, because $15 won't be worth that much anymore. And it's this slow decline in everything. That's an economic example, but it's, moral values, everyone can see that that's declined over time. Your military power is, of course, eroding, because you just don't have the human capital to keep it at a proper level. I know of these stories that, for example, for submarines and aircraft carriers of the United States Navy, they can't get enough qualified personnel to maintain the reactors. So they have to keep increasing the wages to just be able to pull them out of the civilian sector. But the overall level of personnel is just declining across the board in the United States military. So it won't be an overnight collapse. It'll just be this slow downward collapse. And yes, it will be a slide into neo-feudalism, because as the value of the dollar declines, that won't matter too much for elites or people who already hold assets, who are wealthy already, because they can move their assets into something other than dollars. They can buy property, they can buy gold, they can buy cryptos, they can buy other currencies. But you, as a normal working person, are still paid in dollars, and you don't have that many options, generally speaking, to invest in other asset classes. So for you, it's going to be worse and worse, and your purchasing power and your economic strength is going to keep declining. And that's more or less where they want it, because, as I say, nationalism is the ideology of the middle class, and if the middle class has money, they can finance things that will support their own interests, as historically has happened. I think the United States has never had this culture of grassroots NGOs and small donations as much as it happened, for example, in Germany. But in Germany, in the 19th century, early 20th century, it used to be quite common for the middle class to actively finance political parties and NGOs that would support their own interests. So they want to prevent that. So yeah, slow slide into slow collapse, slow slide into neo feudalism, and slow decline of the common man's power.
Yeah, and I think being invested, devoting your time or being emotionally invested in electoral politics is a waste of time, especially with the current climate. So my advice to Americans would be to focus on building up social capital, building up bonds, including like building up families, community, rather than being invested in politics. And that would include like building up patronage networks that would provide people jobs.
Yeah, electoral politics is useless for you because you're stuck in your first past the post and two-party system. For us, it's a bit different, because we've got, in the Netherlands, if you get 70,000 votes, you can get a seat in parliament. The bar is very much lower, so we have way too many parties, really, as it is. But it's much lower. Electoral politics kind of works here. They find other ways to neutral us, of course. In the end, even if the Netherlands were to turn into a very hard-line nationalist country, we're still just one country, and we're surrounded by much more powerful countries. We have to do what Germany says. So in the end, yes, electoral politics is always less relevant than building networks and especially building alternative economic power, I think. I think it's generally good an idea to do what the elites do and get out of the dollar if you can. Get gold, get cryptos, get anything else that's an asset that will keep its value somewhat. And then you can reinvest that into political goals.
You had the video about the OK Boomer meme. And yeah, a lot of the criticisms of that generation, I think the baby boomer is the first generation to fully embrace like liberalism and also values of liberal values, consumerism, radical individualism, and then any kind of like the failure to pass down any form of like intergenerational wealth. Yeah. And the problem is a lot of like the left will focus on the OK Boomer meme and bash them. Their view is more that they're holding on, that they're regressive, and that that generation is bigoted and not and willing to embrace the changes that they're putting forth. So they're, you put forth like criticisms of that generation, but from a different perspective.
I think boomers kind of have it hard and easy at the same time. On the one hand, their own kids and grandkids don't like them. They hate what they've done, both the left and right. The right, of course, thinks that they've destroyed the civilization. The left thinks they're not progressive enough and that they're all backwards. On the other hand, they are the wealthiest generation to have ever lived in history and probably will continue to be for a while, so they shouldn't complain too much. But yeah, it's one of those things where narratives and perspectives are very different. It's an interesting thing, right? To us, it's the baby boomer generation of May 1968 is the example of when the floodgates broke and you know the last vestiges of Christian civilization and traditional values were wiped away. But to the perspective of a far left left winger who's in favor of transgenderism and God knows what else, they're very conservative. My father is a baby boomer. He's a communist, or a Marxist, as he likes to say. I don't care about the difference, to be honest. But he always says that the left today is too obsessed with gender and so on. So I can understand why a left-winger would, to some extent, have this perspective on baby boomers. And yeah, about the intergenerational wealth thing, well, Americans are probably more familiar with this than anyone else, with their concept of reverse mortgages, for example. Baby boomers have sort of, they've inherited all the cultural and economic wealth of a thousand-year-old civilization, at least in Europe, and they've eaten it. They've consumed it all. They've destroyed the human capital, the social capital. They've actively destroyed the economic value by outsourcing labor and destroying the manufacturing industry by, well, just buying RVs and going on expensive holidays rather than passing their wealth on to their children. So I think, yeah, pretty much the worst generation to ever live, the most selfish. And they're sort of the embodiment of liberal values, I'd say, really. Individualism and leading to selfishness.
With millennials and Gen Z, like they're embracing left-wing values or woke values, but it's a different, I think it's like a different strain of, it's bad, I mean, they're embracing, it's bad, but in a different sense.
Yeah, it's much more socially focused, whereas the old, I mean, the old sort
well,
of
style. Well, more, I guess it is more, it's bad and good in different ways, it's bad. I think what, like, the values people my age and younger are embracing, the woke stuff is obviously bad, but there is some positive in a sense that they're embracing values that are more communal and more tribally focused.
Yeah, I guess in this sort of unaware way, right? Like the way that hipsters are, in a sense, very, very European in what they appreciate.
You had a video on the Dutch channel about South Africa. What are your thoughts on that nation? You mentioned Orania. Do you see like some kind of partition? Like there's that movement, the civic nationalist, like Western Cape independence, or do you support some kind of right of return to the Netherlands or the UK?
Well, ideally we'd reconquer it, but that's of course a pipe dream, unfortunately. I think whites in South Africa they don't have a future there. Not even just because of the conditions there. If the geopolitical situation and the general Western culture were better, maybe they could survive. But anti-white hatred that is fermented in the United States get exported over there as well, and it aggravates it and aggravates and aggravates it. And with 50 million blacks against only 6 or so million whites who hate them, and any self-defense is immediately worse, ends up being even worse for you, they just don't have a future there unless things change drastically. So I'd say we need to actively lobby for a right of return in Europe, because otherwise they're going to end up genocided. And projects like Orania and Kleinfontein, these are stopgaps to keep people safe as much as possible. They're little safe havens, but especially things like a secessionist movement, they don't have the power locally, and if they were to try, they'd be smacked down so hard by the international community, it would be impossible.
The Western Cape is more like civic nationalism, the Cape independence.
Yeah, I understand, but any sort of thing, anything where, even if there were an active genocide going on and they were cutting heads of whites and putting them on spikes in the streets and this were on the news, even then, I don't think a secessionist movement or even any rhetoric of self-preservation could exist, simply because the culture is so anti-white now that even saying anything like, well, maybe it was a bad idea to let them genocide people in South Africa, even that would be too much. The culture is just too anti-white.
Initially, before the British came in, there were these like small kind of semi-autonomous states like the Transvaal Republic. Do you think that the British invasion had a negative impact?
Oh yeah, very much. Transvaal and Oranje Vrijstaat. They were countries, roughly speaking. They were nation states. Yeah, I think that if the British had not invaded these states, then we would be having a very different situation in South Africa now. I think you'd have a white state back there, because the region where Transvaal and Vrijstaat, Oranje Vrijstaat were, there were no blacks there. And in fact, in the original Cape, there were no blacks either. Blacks and especially Indians were imported very much under the British rule. And if after, even after the Dominion and so on, if in the 1950s, there could have been a separate white state and a separate black state, then that would probably have kept things more peaceful as well. So I think, firstly, the Boer Wars were completely morally unjustifiable. They were sheer wars for greed. In fact, it was one of the major reasons that the Netherlands refused to enter World War I, and we passively helped the Germans because we had such resentment for the British. And I think that indirectly, British rule has been a disaster for South Africa.
You had a video about archaeofuturism.
Several.
And, yeah, several about issues in architecture, the style and the building material in response to traditionalists like Wrath of Ghanaan. And I think he does put out a lot of good material. But
I do.
Yeah, he does, but the traditionalists are very kind of rigid, like they just want to kind of copy and paste styles from the past, and they just create like replicas of like a 19th century small town. It's very rigid. So is the issue more like with architecture, what do you see as more important, the styles, the aesthetic, or the building material, like whether you use like traditional brick or like a steel frame?
Well, with Wrath of Ghanaan, the problem is he sometimes just goes straight into ludism, where he rejects modern methods simply because they're modern. He has good points where he's trying to rehabilitate traditional techniques and so on. I kind of hold to the view of Kierkegaard of aesthetics, that there are simple objective beauty standards, and you can make beautiful things with modern materials. You can make beautiful things with glass and steel. There's very beautiful greenhouses, for example, in London. And you can make beautiful things with modern techniques, and you can make things cheaper and faster and mass-produced and still keep you beautiful. I think the fundamental problem with modern architecture is the aesthetics. It's not necessarily the materials, although some materials are just useless. Cement, concrete. This is actually quite inferior material. It has a very low lifespan. So some materials, yes, they are inferior. Plastics have their downsides. For example, they're quite difficult pollutants to remove. But mass-produced brick, for example, using steel, these are perfect ways to improve construction with modern materials. But you can still use the old styles. And I think you can even innovate in styles, to, and that can be beautiful. But yeah, modern architecture, I think, is ugly because it's ideologically meant to be ugly. I think there's this sort of, I don't know how you would describe it in English, but this thinking where they actively want to destroy what came before, the hatred for the idea of objective beauty. So someone like Rem Koolhaas, he has an ideological need to destroy beauty, I think.
So yeah, like what's considered like modern architecture today, as opposed to the concept of like archaeofuturism or retrofuturism, is sort of, it's futuristic, but borrows from the past, like sort of how the past, the optimism of how the past vision of like the brighter future, and these different kind of genres. I think you posted images like Victorian, like the Victorian vision of the future, which is sometimes called steampunk, Art Nouveau, Art Deco, like the Art Deco skyscrapers of New York City, and even under communism, like the neo-Gothic towers in Moscow, and then these kind of different proposals. I'm not sure if you're familiar, but in Victorian London, like in the late 19th century, there was a proposal to turn the to take the building material from the Crystal Palace and build the world's tallest skyscraper out of the Crystal Palace, but it didn't really work out because of like engineering issues. And there were some, I mean, there were some Art Deco towers in Europe, like Deboratoren in Antwerp, the Senate House in London, and then also like Italian futurism, that kind of architecture under Mussolini. But there was like overall in that era, there was a kind of resistance to mega structures, like they saw like with the like comparable to New York City as part of Americanization. What are your general thoughts on like mega structures and retrofuturism and archaeofuturism and architecture?
Yeah, I think Art Deco, Art Nouveau are very much examples of how you can make beautiful things with newer styles. One of my favorites is the German version of Art Nouveau, Jugendstil. Yeah, these are exactly examples of what we could look to for inspiration to improve modern architecture. So, yeah, these would be examples. As for megastructures, I'm not sure what you mean by that. I mean, yeah, we have megastructures these days. I'm not sure that's necessarily an American influence. Rome has some pretty impressive churches and, you know, fora and so on. And Versailles is pretty monumental. Palatial estates and so on. So I'm not sure that's a necessarily American thing. I think it's more the economic needs that make such huge structures sometimes to be the choice to go to.
Are Dutch suburbs fairly compact and walkable?
We don't have suburbs quite the same way in the Americans do. So it's more of a still a slightly more organic neighborhood. But we do have this dichotomy. Like the standard European city didn't used to have this huge distinction between central business districts and commercial zones, industrial areas, and then suburbs. It used to be all pretty integrated, closely together. So you'd have the center of the city where people would live, the shops would be, the markets would be, the government buildings would be, and then on the outskirts you'd have the industry that was too polluting, like leather workers and you know, things that produce a lot of filth and stench and so on. So it was never this hard distinction that you had in American cities, which were so planned with their industrial zones and commercial zones and residential zones. That's more and more common now, but it's still not completely the way the Americans have this really segmented society. It's if they build a new neighborhood here, it'll still have integrated schools and integrated shops, and it'll be less of this very harsh distinction. So I think they're still more livable, but in a way, it's also becoming more segregated as well, and not just in how it's planned, but also demographically, of course. So that's also something you see happening, where you've got neighborhoods that are predominantly Moroccan or predominantly Turkish or predominantly Black. And we've got some of our own forms of white flight as well. Of course, there's much less place to flee to, so it's closer back together still.
Do you have thoughts on the impact of architecture and urban planning on the social capital and just on the impacts on psychology? There's issues traditionalists talk about, like the impact that hyper-density might lead to stress, mm-hmm. but there's obviously, if you're in an ex-urban area where it's low density and you're living in, like, a single-family home on a half-an-acre plot, a lot of those communities are totally atomized. So what are your thoughts on what is ideal, what kind of urban layout and level of density would be ideal for social capital?
I think the primary thing is the aesthetics, is the look of the town. If you're constantly surrounded just by glass, steel, and concrete, this is depressive. I think that takes a toll on the psyche. It's not even necessarily the monumentality of these huge skyscrapers that you stare up into the sky and you see them without end. I think it's more that they're so ugly.
I mentioned, like, the Bora Torin in Antwerp. Like, what are your thoughts, like, yeah. from the Art Deco era? Like, those types of skyscrapers, as opposed to, like, the newer kind of boxes that you would see, like, in Rotterdam.
Yeah, no, that's a perfect example. I think the Chrysler Building or the Empire State Building, for example, that's a much... These are still a bit too big, a bit too plain, but they are much better than just a complete glass box, right? So that would be a massive improvement. So I think primarily the aesthetics is important, but also this harsh corners. You know, American cities are always so square, and you've got these intersections, and it's all squares and rectangles. And that's not how nature looks. Nature is rounds and curves, and if you walk a goat trail in nature, it'll take all these random turns and curves. So a city, it needs its squares and it needs its unexpected dead ends and alleys. That's more close to how nature works. And I think, you know, in a sense, that's what evolution prepared us for. We might evolutionarily adapt to that. I mean, all animals are quite adaptive. We might, if we live long enough in urban environments, we might become adapted to that and not find it so strange. I'm not sure you want that kind of selection, though. I think urban environments are a pretty piss-poor selection mechanism, because everything, environmental, economic, cultural, are genetic. They promote certain kinds of genetic traits. They promote who reproduces. They promote who thrives. And it's always a selection mechanism. Everything is constantly a selection mechanism. So I think urban environments are pretty negative, as they are selection pressure on our current genetics. They're going to make us less empathetic, less able to socialize, more callous. So, yeah.
And there's the same problem with a lot of, like, the lower density American suburbs. It's just like you have a street that's very car oriented with like one-story structures or strip malls, and then on the side it's all residential with single-family homes. There's very little, like, pedestrian traffic, and that's definitely problematic. Like, having
the
public spaces are crucial for social capital.
Yeah, yeah, and in America, like, I've never been to the United States, but when I see in movies what I see from series and so on, what I hear from people is, if you live in a suburb, there's nothing around except houses. There's, you know, you go to a centrally planned school, there's no shops, and you need to have a car to survive. I don't think that's very natural ways of living, but again, people can adapt to that.
There's this kind of movement called New Urbanism, which it attempts to kind of retrofit suburbia into creating more cohesive social spaces, but it's sort of a luxury. A lot of these kind of developments, they're a positive trend, but they tend to be very expensive.
I think generally, this is one of the problems we have generally. We can have all kinds of good ideas. I read fantastic suggestions on economic policy, environmental policy, on how we could improve our architecture and urbanism. The problem is we don't have any way to get these implemented. They are not attractive to the people in power because either because our ideology makes it tainted, or because it's more expensive, or because it doesn't suit the current policies and thinking. So the big problem is we have all these fantastic ideas. You could write a whole party program. You could write a whole books about it. People have, in fact, written books about this, but it's not implementable. And I heard someone say this recently, and I think it's a very important point to make, is we need to get away from all of the thinking about the problems and how we're going to solve them, and we need to look a lot more pragmatically about how we're going to get any power to implement even the most basic ideas. Okay, we want less migration. We don't need to talk about that much about why we want less migration, what the ideological reasons are, or whether Italians are white or not. What we need to talk about is how can we get any form of power that will in some way enable us to implement something towards lessening migration. I'm much more of a pragmatist on this, which is why one of the reasons I think Wilders is perfectly fine enough to support for now, because at least it's a step in the right direction. I don't agree with these people who are constantly fighting with people in the, you know, people who hate Americans, who hate to on the Republicans, who are somewhat on their side because they're not hardline enough. Just this is a first step. You need baby steps before you can walk. You need to crawl before you can walk. So be more pragmatic. Think about how you're going to get any form of power, how you're going to get economic backing, how you get a financial system or finances go together to get things done. Don't think so much about all this philosophy, because the philosophy has been worked out pretty well by now.
Yeah, I agree. I think it is. It is kind of foolish and naive to advocate to take like a grandiose position if you have like a zero power influence and social capital. Before I wrap up the show, do you have any thoughts on, we did talk about like what you expect to see in America. Do you have any thoughts on like the current trends and political situation in Europe, just general thoughts on what you expect to see over the next several years?
Again, that very much depends on what happens in America. I think if America continues to decline, we're going to see a bit of a reorientation in Europe. We're already seeing this. There were some policy papers being published after this corona crisis in Europe where, and these were senior figures in NGOs and so on, talking about how we need to bring some manufacturing back of vital industries, how we need to look more to our own defense because America can't keep protecting us forever. I think some people in top positions are sort of realizing America is in decline. We don't quite know what Joe Biden's going to do, so that's still a bit of a wild card. But it's either going to be business as usual, and what happens in America very much reflects back here, and things, you know, you get BLM protests, we get BLM protests. You get, repression and censorship, we get repression and censorship. Or we start getting a bit of a reorientation where European nations and the EU start thinking, well, we need to start turning away from the USA because it's starting to fail. I think this is economically already happening somewhat, like I say, about defense and manufacturing spending, but especially the dollar. We are starting to diverge with the ECB from the Fed. We're printing much less, and that has to do with, of course, a different economic situation. We've got multiple countries, multiple business cycles, and different levels of debt and so on. But, for example, Germany, Netherlands, Belgium, Denmark, and so on, we are kind of starting to get sick and tired of the print more policy, and we're starting to distrust the dollar. So I think we're going to start seeing the change away there first, and then maybe slightly culturally. But again, that's very unpredictable. I think it's very possible as well that we are just going to continue to follow you off a cliff, and when you fall off a cliff, maybe we'll learn a lesson, but maybe we fall off the cliff after you. So it's still hard to say. On the whole, this is why I want to disassociate from America, because I think unless we start considering ourselves as our own civilizational power and our own culture, we are going to keep following you off that cliff. And the only way to prevent you from falling off the cliff is for the United States to regain its sense of purpose, to become more nationalistic and isolationist, and start acting more in its own interest. But as you see with Trump, I haven't seen that being very successful in the last few years, and I don't see that improving either.
Yeah, it's as I said like earlier in the show, it's like the worst both worlds. Like the now, I mean, now things are really bad with what happened in D.C. Like the establishment is treating Trump supporters like neo-Nazis, but at the very same time, like his policies have been fairly standard, like mainstream conservative policies. So it's, yeah, it's, I mean, it's a really bad political situation in America. Do you want to plug your two YouTube channels or any other projects or websites you have?
Yeah. So I should maybe have done this at the beginning, but what I do is, yeah, I barely introduced myself, of course. What I do is I try to build up an online presence for Dutch nationalism, because that's very much lacking here. So I have this Dutch YouTube channel called Tietse Bazuin, in which I sort of try to imitate PragerU's style of making videos, but with more nationalistic topics, where I make these sort of infomercial sort of videos. And then I publish an arts and history magazine quarterly, also called Tietse Bazuin, and I speak events. And as soon as this corona stuff is over, I hope to start organizing events again. And then I have my English YouTube channel, which is much more, I just post things where I reflect about philosophy and economics and technology on there. Things that I think are interesting and are not talked about enough in nationalist spheres, I tend to put on there to hopefully get a conversation going, really. That's my idea.
Faust, it has been an excellent show. Thank you so much for being on.
Thank you very much for inviting me.